use of telemedicine, of course, increased, but variable based on where, you know, globally increased. Now 93% of docs are using it. I think before it was very minimal, even though people were using it. But obviously, this is kind of interesting. We asked them about their typical week. We asked you as well. And again, you know, I guess we can break these down. It's kind of hard to say, you know, now it seems like the geographic differences, as you were saying, are kind of decreasing a little bit.
Right.
But you still have a lot of people being seen in clinic. Not too much email or telemedicine, I think, across the country.
Right.
This is the procedures of the staff, again, pretty much everywhere.
Right.
Clinical trials, the people who were doing clinical trials, two-thirds of them say that it's decreased. I would imagine it's maybe even more than that, but I don't know. Cancer surgery, two-thirds went through a period where they had less access to cancer surgery, radiation therapy. We asked them, are you trying to avoid giving any particular set of drugs? Most of them said no. We asked them whether they thought various treatments affected their susceptibility or risk of complications. So most of them think that checkpoint inhibitors don't.
Good.
I don't know that we asked them about neutropenia because I've been hearing about that a little bit. Pembro, it's interesting. Still a fair number of people are using it every 3 weeks, which I think is interesting.
Interesting. Right. I think that if there's the flexibility, which we know Pembro has for every 6 weeks, to be able to dose your patients and keep them out of the hospital with less frequency, then that seems favorable to me.
Although, you know, it's interesting, like the lung people, they get a little nervous about starting somebody. They kind of want to see what's going on because, you know, you give a little bit of higher dose. It's not like I thought everybody was going to start using every 6 weeks. Not quite exactly, like maybe different places.
I think this is where telemedicine has been so helpful, though, because you could have a quick telemedicine check-in at whatever frequency you would like, even if your dosing of when that patient has to come on site is spaced out.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, we hear a lot of stories, too, of telemedicine visits, and yet the patient's coming in to get an infusion or an injection.
Right.
But they still don't see him like the GU people do that.
Yeah.
This is kind of interesting, which is, would you test the patient you're about to begin therapy on? So when we say systemic therapy, of course, we can break it down, but it's kind of split. A lot of people are actually testing people, I hear, with chemotherapy as well. About to go surgery, of course, there, you know, you can understand it. Radiation therapy, it's split. It looks like you all generally test people coming for surgery, but not radiation or systemic. What's the thinking there?
So we've done a lot of thinking and talking about this with our infection control folks. And the struggle was that for systemic therapy, just testing at the beginning would seem inadequate. And how people are living within their communities and they could potentially constantly be at risk. So then are you testing with every subsequent dose? And in the setting of limited resources for testing, that seemed like a difficult recommendation to come down with. So having those important screening questions seemed to be a helpful filter of who might then need testing. In surgery, it's easy to understand that if there's going to be anesthesia, intubations, closer proximity to the head and neck, production of respiratory or droplet secretions, that there you really needed to know that folks were cleared before coming into that environment. But with chemotherapy, we elected not to do it just as a surveillance test.
How much are you attempting to avoid neutropenia, either in terms of dosing of the chemo or use of growth factors?
So I actually think as time has gone on that it may be lymphopenia that's a bigger concern than neutropenia.
That's interesting.
Routinely, if I think about the adjuvant setting, we tend to use a lot of dose-dense AC, in which case I'm always there using growth factor with it to support the dose density. I've tried to really choose regimens that will minimize neutropenia or at least incorporate supportive care if I need to with growth factor.
This is kind of interesting. Fair number of people have had exposure to patients with cancer and COVID already. I was really surprised, but I mean, lots of people there in New York, California, et cetera. Again, I'm not sure exactly how it breaks through, but I think one of the more interesting things, and this is something we're hearing a lot about, as a matter of fact, we did a program with your colleague in CLL, Anthony Matos, about the issue of the patient who looks like they have COVID, but they test negative.
Yes. And that's been quite frustrating, but I think leans on the importance of testing and potentially testing in different modalities, right? So the nasopharyngeal swab, the technique in which you do that was critically important. Antibody testing, I think, has been difficult to interpret. When positive, we know somebody was exposed at some point, but it doesn't tell us about immunity necessarily. So it is really an evolving field. And we really look to the guidance of our infectious disease and infection control experts.
I think it seems like this has been disruptive to most people at this point. I don't know if maybe if we did this 2 months ago, it might have been a little bit different in terms of the burden to the staff. Financial, yeah, that's another thing I'm trying to sort out. I know that, you know, elective surgeries, elective procedures, elective evaluations have been decreased. The research has obviously been affected tremendously. Globally, what kind of impact has this had at Memorial, for example?
You know, I think that while we remained open throughout the pandemic, patients, out of fear, concern, all reasonable given what was going on, elected to stay home and potentially not stay current in the way that we ordinarily would have. So you are seeing delays. You're seeing delays in radiology utilization. You're seeing changes from potentially intravenous administration to oral administration of treatments. Yes, as you said, elective surgeries were temporarily on hold, but the vast majority of surgeries occurring in the cancer population are not elective. And so that was less of an impact for us. We were poised to convert OR rooms to ventilator-supported rooms for critical care, and it really didn't come to needing that. So there is definitely a financial impact when you also look at what's happening with unemployment rates, insurance coverage as a result of patients losing their insurance coverage. And so this is having a global impact economically, as you're aware.
This was very interesting to us in particular, which I was kind of surprised at, which is how disruptive has the pandemic been on your ability to keep up to date with new cancer advances? And I'm surprised to see even you say it's affected that. Can you comment on that?
Sure. So I think what happened is there was just a necessary shift in needing to invest time and understanding about COVID. So over the past few months, it's been a tremendous awareness of what's going on with the pandemic. How can we respond appropriately in our practice? How can we care for our patients? I think it has been outstanding to see the conversion to tele-video remote meetings. ASCO as a virtual meeting really was refreshing to be able to focus again on novel, new, exciting cancer advances. And educational content like this is just wonderful because it is increasingly hard to step away to an in-person meeting, if you will. And having this content is amazing.
So actually, now that I think about it, if I were to do a little survey on myself and my group, I would say in 2019, we didn't do any webinars. And so far in the last 4 months, I think we've done 55. And I think we did like 130 of these one-on-one things that we're doing with you. I am curious, you know, kind of what kind of reactions you're getting from patients. And do you find that patients are concerned that their care, their cancer care is being compromised?
I think that the response that I've heard from my patients has been just a resounding comfort that we've been able to take care of them where their needs are. So it's actually offered a really unique view into patients in their home. I've had the chance to meet family members, caregivers, children. They're showing me around, and it's been an actually really intimate exposure to a side of our patients that we don't necessarily get when they come into our clinic space. And so telemedicine has really allowed for building relationships and care in some ways that we just didn't have access to previously. Communications has been key. Transparency has been key. And dispelling myths has been really important. So we have consistently put out there the importance of call into us. If you have questions, just pick up the phone, give me a call, send me an email so that you're not sitting home fearful, wondering, worrying, and we can just help guide you. And so this has been, I think, a real bonding experience, but certainly frightening. Folks have been struggling with trying to be primary educators for their children at home. Partners are working from home, and it has placed tremendous stress on our patients. And it's always been a stressful experience. This just amplifies it.
So, you know, it's interesting. I was talking with a general medical oncologist this morning, and he was telling me about a patient who was 95 who he saw virtually without meeting, a patient and daughter on a telemedicine. He actually had non-invasive bladder cancer, started the patient on pembrolizumab and didn't end up seeing him for, you know, several weeks. Patient did great, et cetera. But I was curious, when you met him for the first time compared to when you, you know, were talking to him with his daughter on telemedicine, was there anything that came through for you that was different? And he said, I got a better understanding of how scared he was, that I couldn't really feel it as much. But when I sat with him in the room, I felt it much more. And I don't know, I guess there's a limit to what you can get when you're not physically in contact with somebody.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think this will forever replace the in-person visit, but it complements it. And I think that it's offered patients tremendous flexibility and security that they're not divorced from or cut off from their primary cancer caregiver as a result of this pandemic. You know, we've had transportation issues, mass transit suspended at times, and it's been a really frightening experience for patients even to commute into the city. So this has really allowed us to remain in touch. But yeah, there's value for sure to inpatient experiences as well.
So one final question, which is in terms of the future of telemedicine as it relates to clinical research, because one of the issues, you know, obviously right now things are in such transition, is the question of whether or not we could use it more and maybe get more people involved with trials. Because, you know, there are a lot of people who don't want to travel to tertiary centers. Do you think that maybe we could move towards a situation where maybe we use more telemedicine in clinical research, get more people into trials?
I think that's a great take-home message, that we've had great luck communicating with sponsors, talking about the importance of telemedicine to accept those visits, to understand moving forward, we should be writing our trials to allow for virtual visits, to allow for shipping of investigational oral agents to home. And really, by reducing barriers, we can improve accrual and then improve access to some of these great novel agents to patients who otherwise wouldn't have been able to participate.